Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is Williams College professor, scholar, and author Susan Dunn. Susan is the author of a dozen books. Some are on Franklin Roosevelt and others on the Founding Fathers and the Revolutionary Generation. In addition to her new book, 1940, FDR Wilkie Lindbergh Hitler, The Election Amid the Storm, she also wrote Roosevelt's Purge, How FDR Fought to Change the Democratic Party. And she wrote with her Pulitzer Prize-winning co-author James McGregor Burns, The Three Roosevelts, about Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor Roosevelt. Susan Dunn also writes op-eds for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other papers. I interviewed her a few years ago about a book she edited of essential writings of the Founding Fathers. And here she is again, all the way from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Welcome, Susan Dunn.
Thank you, Alan.
Susan, this book, 1940. Now, you know how I love this stuff. I love writings about Franklin Roosevelt. I'm reading about Winston Churchill right now, the Manchester book, and I can't get enough of it. But here you do an interesting thing. You take a single year, 1940. Why was 1940 so important?
It's such a consequential election, and in a way, it's an election to save civilization itself. Because what happens actually, on the eve of the 1940 Republican Convention, June 22nd, France surrenders to Hitler. And Hitler, starting in May, invaded Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and then France. And Great Britain, in fact, of all the European democracies, is now standing alone. And it is an election that may well decide the fate of Western civilization, of Judeo-Christian morality, of all that we hold dearest, all that is most precious in our civilization, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All of our most fundamental values, in fact, are being threatened by Nazism and Hitler.
You know, Susan Dunn, I love talking to you because you always raise these what-if sort of possibilities. And out of what you just said comes Wendell Willkie. Now, why, at least extract from what you just said, that if Wendell Willkie had won, maybe civilization would not have turned out the way it did if Roosevelt won?
Luckily, that isn't true, that the Republicans, in fact, made a great courageous decision in nominating Wendell Willkie because he was just as much of an internationalist and an anti-Nazi, anti-fascist, as was FDR. So, in fact, the answer to your question would be in Philip Roth's novel,
sure,
called The Plot Against America. If Charles Lindbergh had won the election, then civilization would have been on the rocks. But luckily, the other candidate was Willkie, and it was a win-win situation. Either way, it would have worked out well. And in fact, after Willkie was nominated by the Republican convention, people suggested to FDR that the two run together and have a joint ticket, and they both laughed off that suggestion. But in fact, it's not a bad suggestion, that perhaps the two of them should have run together.
So now you have to tell us something about Wendell Willkie.
Wendell Willkie had never before run for public office. It's very, very unusual. He was a utilities magnate, a lawyer, a World War I veteran, a Hoosier from Indiana. He ran the Southern Utilities Corporation, a vast holding corporation. He was charming. He was intellectual. He had written many articles. In fact, he was way ahead of FDR on the question of civil rights. And perhaps also interesting is that until the end of 1939, he was a Democrat.
So he was what my mother might have called the best of that crowd, of the Republican crowd.
He was, and the Republicans would never have nominated him if it hadn't been for the war.
On the other hand, in terms of the biological concept of guile, did he have the kind of guile that an FDR had? I mean, FDR was always thinking, always planning, bringing the American people along as he needed to do, and to manipulate things. Could Wendell Willkie have done the same kind of job based on his character that the always artful dodger FDR did?
Probably not. He was very charming and very smart, quite articulate. But he wasn't as cagey. He wasn't as much of a fox as FDR. And he wasn't a professional politician. He did, in fact, have amateurs running his campaign. It was a poorly run campaign. Just the question of speech writers, he didn't really know how to give a great speech. And after he'd give a rather dry, monotone speech, he would toss aside his pages and say, okay, now I'm going to talk to the crowd. And then he came alive, and he charmed them, and they loved him. But he had amateur speech writers, or he would write his own speeches, whereas FDR had a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, Robert Sherwood, writing his speeches for him. And Robert Sherwood, even with his great experience on Broadway and with actors and actresses, said that he'd never seen such a great actor as FDR. That when FDR would give a speech, he would know how to modulate his voice and change his tone and have his voice dripping with sarcasm for some remarks and laugh, just like Bill Clinton can, and he would make love to the crowd. And Wilkie didn't know how to do that.
So there was FDR, 1940, the Japanese attack in 1941. So we have to remember that this is still a point at which Winston Churchill is sending telegrams and messages to, as you said before, Great Britain was out there standing alone. You know, Susan Dunn, I don't think most people know what that was, what that meant. You know, we just say they were standing alone, yeah? So here were the Nazis, they were coming in, the map had turned with one big swastika, and there was Churchill doing his thing, trying to ward off this entire thing. They had the Japanese on one hand, they had the Nazis on the other, and there was Great Britain just having to do it alone. The communists, Stalin had made a non-aggression treaty with Hitler, and when you say standing alone, you meant it, didn't you?
Absolutely. One professor who wrote a book that year said, "Who of us lives if England dies?" And I love Alexander Hamilton's remark in the late 18th century, we think in English. This is our great bond, our cultural, intellectual blood bond, perhaps, with British civilization. And now they're being bombed every night by Adolf Hitler's Luftwaffe. We depend on the Atlantic, and the Atlantic is controlled by the British fleet, and that is being attacked by U-boats every day, by Nazi submarines. And so if Britain goes, the United States will be standing alone. And what happens, what's unusual in the year 1940, it's an election season, and FDR wants to win the election, but nevertheless, he puts the fate of the world ahead of his own ambitions, fortunately, and initiates two important programs. One is selective service, which is the first peacetime draft, universal compulsory military training and service. And you would assume that there'd be hundreds of thousands or millions of American families that do not want their sons drafted or their brothers drafted and that they will vote against FDR. Luckily, that didn't happen. But FDR signs selective service, and the first lottery during which they pick draft numbers takes place just days before the election. It was an extremely courageous decision on FDR's part. But he knew that the United States had to be prepared for the worst, even though he would say in his campaign speeches, we are not going to send our boys into foreign wars. And he would make these very unrealistic promises. But nevertheless, deep down, he knew that war was a real possibility and the United States had to be prepared.
Was it just a real possibility, or did he know we were going to go to war?
I think he didn't. I think in the beginning, for quite some time, they thought there could be a quid pro quo, that we would supply Great Britain with all the war materiel that it needed, weapons, airplanes, destroyers, and they would do the fighting for us and they would win. We would gear up our industry, churn out thousands of planes and weapons and bombers and destroyers for Britain, and they would do the fighting for us. So I think that some part of him thought we could avoid war. Nevertheless, at the same time, the military is coming together and making war plans. They do have to be prepared. And the bottom line is that they adopt a plan called Admiral Stark of the Navy, Harold Stark, the chief of naval operations, did realize that the United States needed a strategy, needed priorities, and needed war objectives. So he offered FDR four alternatives, A, B, C, and D. D was adopted, and in the naval phonetic vocabulary, D is dog. So this was Plan Dog, and Plan Dog was defeat Germany first and have a defensive strategy in the Pacific Ocean and put all of the effort and all of the priorities and objectives into an Atlantic first defeat Germany strategy. So at the same time that FDR was promising not to send the boys to war, the country, in fact, was preparing for war. It had to be prepared. One adversary, in fact, of FDR, the Maryland Democrat Millard Tidings, made an intelligent remark and said about a prepared army, I'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Well, you know, it's so tempting to jump ahead from 1940 and see what happens in 1941, because you're right. Everybody, including Churchill and everybody else, was scared to death that FDR was going to do the Japanese first, do the Pacific first, because after all, they're the ones who bombed us. And for the next 5 years, Stalin and all of the others, including Churchill and everybody else, were worried that FDR would shift his focus to the Japanese, who, after all, had been the ones who were responsible for Pearl Harbor. But he never did. He always kept his word, even when we had some of our biggest successes in that defense posture in the Pacific. Yes?
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Even though Churchill himself was a little bit conflicted, they did want Americans to help them in Singapore.
Sure.
And he wanted America to take its fleet out of Pearl Harbor and move it to Singapore because he felt that Singapore was the sine qua non for British colonial possessions in the Pacific.
And that's something else you should set up for us, Susan Dunn, and that is that the British were the imperialists. They had imperial holdings all over the world, and FDR was not.
It's interesting because that's one of the arguments that some isolationists made. The country was ferociously divided in 1940 between the interventionists who did want to help Great Britain, who were anti-fascist, anti-Nazi, and a tremendously powerful isolationist movement. There are various strands in that isolationist movement that we can discuss, but one strand believed that the colonial powers were worse than the Nazis. And they took French colonialism and especially British colonialism to task and would make outrageous statements such as that the British were responsible for far more barbaric cruelty than the Nazis with their colonial policies, etc. That was just one strand.
So from the very beginning, though, FDR, who was a brilliant man, as you know better than anybody, knew full well that when this thing, when the dust settled, Britain, according to his plans, were going to, A, give some stuff up to America, but B, forget about colonialism. They were going to lose their colonial properties.
That was definitely FDR's hope. He was an anti-colonialist, and that didn't immediately happen. What also happened during 1940, just at the same time that the United States was passing the Selective Service Act, was that FDR negotiated a deal, kind of in secret, with Great Britain. America gave Great Britain 50 World War I overage destroyers.
Almost useless.
Almost useless. And in return, we got a very good deal. We got British bases, a 99-year lease, and some were a gift, bases from Newfoundland, Bermuda, and in the Caribbean. And it was very, very important to have those bases, not only to protect our Western Hemisphere, but perhaps especially the Panama Canal.
And that gave bragging rights, did it not, Susan Dunn, to FDR, who could then turn around to the American people and say, look what I got for helping Britain.
Yes, it was a great deal, and he did get credit for that. Absolutely.
So here we have this year. It was pregnant, for want of a better word, 1940. All hell was about to break loose. 1941, December 7th. You know, you and I have talked about this before. I'm still not sure to this day. How much did FDR know about how this was going to unfold? In other words, from 1940, how prescient was he? There are those who, of course, think FDR knew exactly that the Japanese had to attack the country. There are many people who say, nonsense, that's baloney. But it's almost as if you were playing chess and said, okay, good, I'll give you my knight and I'll give you my night and something in order to get this thing going. But FDR certainly knew the Japanese were not happy with us and that we were in some way starving the Japanese from some of the raw material that they needed to run their empire.
Well, it's a complicated question. The bottom line, I would say, is an article by Richard Hofstadter, a famous classic article that I encourage my students to read about the paranoid imagination in American politics, the paranoid style of American politics, and these conspiracy theories. No, FDR did not know that almost his entire fleet would be attacked in Pearl Harbor, and it was the last thing he wanted.
But he did know, did he not, Susan? I'm sorry. But he did know that the United States actions to the Japanese, because we were negotiating after that, were unacceptable. Are you telling me that he didn't know how unacceptable they would be?
I think so, yes. I think that he thought that our fleet in Pearl Harbor was a deterrent. How could they have expected this attack? And I tell my students to just YouTube and see what the Pearl Harbor attack was, how incredibly devastating it is, and see the smoldering ruins of American ships. That, no, it would just be a completely paranoid conspiracy theory to think that America wanted its own fleet to be destroyed.
How much without moral value, if that's the right word, or substantive values, was FDR? I say that because we now have a spate of movies showing that he had a series of lovers, that he was capable. You've written on Eleanor and him, you know, to do what he needed to do. You cheat on your wife, could you cheat on the voters? What do you make of that?
Well, my co-author James McGregor Burns and I have often discussed these questions of politics and morality. And what we have decided is that there is a hierarchy of values. On the bottom of the ladder, we would place virtue, and that would be...
As in sex.
Yes, exactly. And that might be very nice, to be faithful to your wife and respect your matrimonial oath, etc. Not the most important, perhaps, when you're president. Above that kind of personal virtue, we would place ethics, integrity, and honesty. Because in politics, you have to make deals with people and exchanges, and they have to respect your word, and you have to keep your faith in making a deal. Otherwise, the deal disappears and nobody can trust you again. So that's very important. But then there's something perhaps even more important than that, and those are the ultimate values of what I would call our civilization, protecting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What life means is security, national security. And liberty, yes, and the pursuit of happiness, everything that this country stands for, whether you define that as a Republican or as a Democrat. So what I'm saying is that national security, the protection of the country, the protection of the homeland, is more important than anything else, than keeping your word, than possibly deceiving the public, which FDR did on certain occasions. He felt he had no choice. And it's more important than being faithful to your wife or to your scout troop. But it's that question of national security, doing everything that you have to do, right or wrong, to protect the nation and uphold the Constitution, yes.
But don't some of the greatest scoundrels in history always come back to this, I was just protecting the homeland?
In American history?
No, in any history. I mean, you know, Stalin protecting the homeland, Hitler protecting the homeland, and FDR protecting the homeland.
But it isn't just protecting the homeland. It's also protecting our inalienable Enlightenment values of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and not destroying millions of lives the way Stalin did or the way Hitler did.
Of course, at the same time, I want to remind you, it was a few months later that FDR shipped all the Japanese to internment camps. And that wasn't exactly protecting their life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
This is one of the great flaws in FDR's presidency and his character. The so-called internment camps, in which Japanese American citizens of all ages, children, adults, grandparents, elderly people, were interned. And we use the euphemism internment camps. These were, in fact, concentration camps surrounded by barbed wire. Oddly, the Supreme Court upheld this in the Korematsu case. It was outrageous, yes. And very interesting how racially biased it was.
So we didn't put the Germans in internment
Exactly,
camps.
Or yes. The Italians. So, yes, this was a tremendous moral failure.
I wanted to ask you about what else was going on in 1940. You mentioned Lindbergh. That's always a fascinating one. Once a year, I turn the old movie channel on and I watch
The Spirit of St. Louis with Jimmy Stewart.
I watch him flying over to France and the great adulation the American people had for him. I don't think our kids know as much as we do, you know, about him, because he starts this flight. He gets the biggest ticker tape parade in history, mm-hmm. and he is really a national hero.
He is really a hero. And you can also on YouTube see that ticker tape parade. It's phenomenal. And Lindbergh wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book in the 1950s, The Spirit of St. Louis, and Jimmy Stewart starred in the movie. And Jim Burns and I recently saw the movie, and Lindbergh really was a great hero, crossing the Atlantic in a single-engine plane that he himself had designed. It's very, very interesting how heroic, how charismatic he was. And then everybody knows the story of the kidnapping of their child a few years after. The flight is in 1927, a few years after their baby is kidnapped and killed. And Lindbergh and his wife, Anne, can't take the media, the press, the photographers hounding them. And they escape. They cross the Atlantic and they go to Europe. And this is what changes everything. First, they live in England and the English countryside. Then they move to an island off the coast of northern France. And they visit Germany very often because Germany has so many advances in aviation that Lindbergh is fascinated by German aviation, and they treat Lindbergh like the hero he was, and they give him the royal tours of German aviation plants, and he takes their planes up in the air, and Goebbels, the Luftwaffe minister, gives him the medal of the Order of the German Eagle, and Lindbergh falls for all of their propaganda. He eats it up. Not only does he, in fact, realize that Germany is more advanced in aviation than the United States, that's true, but he also eats up fascism. He thinks this country is dynamic and dazzling and efficient, far more efficient than our old-fashioned checks and balances. We debate, we discuss, we have deadlock, we have gridlock, we don't get anywhere. Oh, but fascism and dictatorship. Yes, he thinks that's the future. And not only that, but his wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who's an exquisite writer. It's wonderful to read her diaries because they're written so beautifully. But at the height of the campaign season in 1940, she writes a short book called The Wave of the Future, and it jumps to the bestseller list. The title, The Wave of the Future. And what is the wave of the future? She sees it as fascism. Totalitarianism, so much more modern than old-fashioned, outworn democracy and self-government.
Now, where were they on the Jewish question?
Very anti-Semitic. I don't think Anne Morrow Lindbergh was anti-Semitic, but Charles Lindbergh was. He thought there was a Jewish problem. The violence against Jews in Germany did shock him. In fact, at one point, they were going to move to Berlin right on the eve of Kristallnacht. And at that point, they are shocked by this violence against Jews, and they stay in France and then ultimately decide to move back to the United States and not even give up their American citizenship as they had thought they might. But Lindbergh is anti-Semitic, and he thinks that there's a Jewish conspiracy to push the nation into war, to push the United States into war, that this comes from Jews. And he says the Jews own our media, our newspapers, and Hollywood studios. In fact, there are quite a few Jewish heads of Hollywood studios, but he blames American movies. And it's very interesting that in the fall of 1941, he gets some congressmen and senators to hold hearings against Hollywood movies, saying that these movies are American propaganda or Jewish propaganda to push the nation into war. What movies? Movies like The Wonderful Mortal Storm or Sergeant York or Confessions of a Nazi Spy with Edward G. Robinson. So Congress holds hearings about the Hollywood studios. And the interesting question is who represents the Hollywood studios during these congressional hearings, and it's Wendell Willkie, who lost the 1940 election to FDR, but has become by this time FDR's partner in trying to help Great Britain and in being absolutely uncompromising toward Nazi aggression.
We're talking to the wonderful Susan Dunn. The book is 1940, FDR, Wilkie, Lindbergh, Hitler, The Election Amid the Storm. So did Lindbergh ever meet Hitler?
They crossed paths at the Berlin Olympics in 1936 or 38.
A very famous Olympics because a lot went on there. But I guess I want to know what happened to Lindbergh. I mean, here was, as you say, the apex of popularity. Ticker tape parade, there was nobody more admired. Now he chooses the wrong horse. He starts on fascism, anti-Semitism, and it's a long fall down. But it was fast, wasn't it?
Yes. He was stunned by the news of Pearl Harbor. He said, how did the Japanese get there? Because one of his arguments, and it was an isolationist argument in general, that the United States was so protected by two vast oceans that no Air Force could ever attack us. And so when Lindbergh saw that the United States fleet, in fact, had been attacked, he was stunned. And he wanted to do his part, and he wanted to serve in the Air Force. He had a commission, and FDR said, thanks, but no thanks. You're out. And FDR would not accept him back. Lindbergh obviously resigned his commission, but he did fly missions for an aviation company that was testing out some bombers in the Pacific. And Lindbergh did fly some missions.
Well, what does this tell us about FDR, to be fair? I mean, FDR is one of my great heroes, obviously. But what does it tell us that here comes a guy, says, okay, I was wrong. Let me participate in the war. Let me fly for you. And he says, no.
He could hold some grudges.
Well, was it stupid, though? In other words, Wendell Willkie's easy because they're on the same philosophical bent. But why consign Lindbergh to the dung heap?
That's an interesting question. In a way, you're right that Lindbergh could have made a technical contribution. On the other hand, perhaps you might want more than just that technical expertise. You might also want a moral contribution, a moral commitment to an anti-fascist, anti-Nazi cause.
But if he was willing to do that.
But he didn't really make that commitment because in his writings, he continued to express his own racial ideas. He was a racialist. He believed in racial purity. And he felt that Hitler was right to defend the pure white Aryan race. One of Lindbergh's friends, and one of the reasons he moved to this odd little island off the northern coast of France in the early 1930s, was that one of his mentors lived there, Alexis Carrel, who had worked actually briefly at Rockefeller University in New York, then moved back to France, and he was a eugenicist. He believed in using genetic material to exclude inferior genetic strands and create a master race. And Lindbergh bought into that racialism also. And interestingly, you brought up the question of mistresses. Lindbergh had a wonderful wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, but in the 1950s, he dumped her. And he had two German mistresses, and he had children in Germany with his mistresses. And I quip in my book that perhaps he wanted to make up for the lack of genetic purity that he found in the United States by having children and a mistress in Germany. But questions like that, his racial ideas, his anti-Semitic ideas, that he never really got over.
What happens to Lindbergh in the United States? What are the people thinking about him now that he isn't, you know, with them anymore? They're fighting this great war. Of course, it didn't start in 1940, but they're fighting this great war eventually. What happens to Lindbergh?
I don't think that he's that much of a player anymore after Pearl Harbor. And probably he does disappear from the world stage until the 50s when he writes his book, The Spirit of St. Louis. But in 1940, he is the spokesman, the public voice for the isolationist movement, and that's his heyday.
And we have to understand really what that meant. You know, you say it in a wonderful professorial tone, Susan Dunn, but this guy really was the head propagandist, and he really gave these big speeches to huge crowds, and he represented a big part of the, as you said before, of the American split on going to war again.
And because he was such a hero, a charismatic spokesman, many people trusted him and believed him, and he was a great expert in aviation. So when he said that the American continent is completely protected, a safe lone island, people believed him. When he said that America should do more to appease Hitler, many people believed him. When he said that FDR had said terrible things against Hitler and had dared to alienate Hitler, many people believed him on that, too.
To this day, anybody writes a book about Hitler, it's going to be popular. I mean, Hitler is still one of the most interesting people in the history of mankind, simply because he was so evil.
That is exactly the word I was going to use.
Yeah, he was so
pure evil.
He was so evil.
Yes.
Nevertheless, I want you to take us back to 1940 a little bit and tell us about the Hitler we were seeing back then.
Well, we see the face of his army and his air force. As I mentioned, taking over the whole Atlantic seaboard from Norway down to France.
And but I'm sorry to interrupt you, but even before that, we had the First World War, that little matter. And then there was, you know, was agreements made, and Hitler clearly broke those agreements.
Yes, and that brings us to Woodrow Wilson and the end of World War I and the Versailles Treaty. This incredibly punitive Versailles Treaty that made Germany pay huge reparations to the Allies, as if Germany were the only nation at fault in World War I, which is clearly not true, and many new books are coming out to show that these crazy alliances sparked the war and then permitted millions of people to die in pointless, senseless slaughter with mustard gas and trench warfare. It was a crazy war. But nevertheless, at the Versailles Treaty that ended World War I, Germany is blamed unilaterally, that all of the blame is placed on Germany. These huge reparations are inflicted upon Germany. And the argument can be made that because Germany was undergoing such tremendous economic suffering, that gave a platform to Hitler to rise.
But there could be another argument made. I know that Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau believed that the German national character was so wanting that he wanted to make them into an agrarian society and never let them go any further than that because of what we now reject as a concept, but we used to talk about back in the day when we read Jim Burns' books, was national character. Were the Germans so evil in their own national character that they were never going to change? And therefore, your argument that maybe our punitiveness on World War I was really not the issue. The issue was their bellicosity and the rest.
I couldn't accept an argument like that, that there
because
is such a national character, because you don't see that today in Germany.
Are you sure?
They have some neo-Nazi white supremacist movements and parties, but they also...
Well, why do you think it's illegal to participate as a neo-Nazi in Germany? Because perhaps the people who are running that country have a sense of who they are.
I think it is more shame and coming to terms, as Germany has far more than Austria, from what I understand, that Germany has sincerely tried to come to terms with this evil in its past and to do everything it can to atone for this tremendous evil. I've had some German exchange students at Williams College in my classes, and I must say that these young people changed my mind about Germany. I dedicate the book to my parents, to my mother, Ruth Dunn, who fled from Germany in 1938. That gives you my own personal story, and my father, U.S. Army Captain Carl Dunn, who served in Panama during the war. So it's a very personal story.
Yeah, but the concept of national character has been pretty well discredited. You certainly don't believe in it. I'm not so sure.
No, I don't believe in it. And as I was saying, these young students whom I had at Williams changed my mind. Because of my mother's experience in Germany, I think I was very, very full of anger at Germany, sometimes overcome with feelings of anger. And this younger generation really changed my mind. In fact, once we were talking about French nationalism, and one German young woman said to me, "Oh, in Germany, we don't talk about nationalism. We're not proud of nationhood." They have a different vocabulary now for talking about these things.
So talk to me a little bit more about Hitler. You know, there's a theory, a great man theory of great evil man theory of life, that these constellations you're talking about, FDR, Lindbergh, Wilkie, Hitler, if you had replaced any one of these people, the question then becomes, would the outcome have been very different? If there had not been a Hitler, that one man, would we have faced what we ended up facing?
That's a great question. I don't think so. I think that one man was responsible. I wished that some of the assassination attempts had succeeded. In fact, that's one of my greatest wishes. When you see documentaries of Hitler in an open car going through the streets of German cities, it just occurs to me that so many people had a chance to assassinate him. Of course, the few assassination attempts failed. There was the famous von Stauffenberg attempt, and Hitler just shifted over in his chair a few feet, and the bomb went off in the wrong spot. But yes, I do think that in that case, it wouldn't have happened.
Talk to me about one person who's not in the group. We have Wilkie, Lindbergh, Hitler, but we don't have Churchill. How come? I mean, you said before they were standing all alone. His standing up and saying, we're not giving up no matter what. And it looked terrible. It looked like they were going to invade any day. They were blitzing it. They were killing Londoners and all the rest. So how come Churchill isn't in this book?
Well, Churchill had just recently become prime minister, first of all. Where Churchill does become important, is more important, is immediately after the election. In December 1940, FDR is tired and he goes on a cruise to relax. And at that point, Churchill sends him a letter, and the letter arrives on FDR's ship, and he reads the letter on December 7th, December 8th. And the letter says that Britain is running out of money. Britain has no more cash assets to pay for American planes and ships, because we have up to then had a policy called cash and carry. They pay for weapons, and they take them. They're responsible also for shipping their own weapons across the Atlantic. And now Britain is saying that they no longer have money. They're out of money. They're broke. What's going to happen? How are we going to help them? And Churchill wrote numerous drafts of this letter. This letter was so important. How to convince FDR to give Britain everything it needed. And FDR thinks about it. Returns home from the cruise the next day, December 17th, he holds a press conference, and he says, suppose your neighbor's house
is... 1940 now.
Still 1940. December 1940, December 17th, press conference. And FDR says, suppose your neighbor's house is on fire, and he doesn't have water to put out that fire. You have a hose. Will you lend him your garden hose so that he can put out that fire? Yes, of course, you're going to lend him the hose. Are you going to charge him for the hose? Are you going to say first, hey, buddy, I want $20 for the hose? No, you're going to give him the hose so he can put out the fire. And FDR calls that lend-lease. And that becomes the most crucial policy of World War II. That changes the whole tide of the war. And it's passed in March 1941. But between December 17th, 1940, and March 41, it's being debated in Congress. Joe Kennedy, the ambassador to Great Britain, comes back and testifies.
A stinker.
Super stinker comes back and testifies against Lend-Lease.
Yeah, he does.
He says Britain is finished. FDR, you said he didn't want any part of Lindbergh. Yes, he doesn't want any part of Joe Kennedy either. After Joe Kennedy is head of the SEC and ambassador to Great Britain, he's finished. His goose is cooked. His political career is over. He testifies against Lend-Lease. Lindbergh is there testifying against Lend-Lease. But who testifies for Lend-Lease? Wendell Willkie, great hero. A man of tremendous humanity, integrity, and heart.
Of course, the Kennedys never forgave a lot of people for having rejected Joe Kennedy. And Robert Kennedy went to his grave fighting that battle to hold up the reputation of Papa Joe Kennedy, who really, as we have just said, was a stinker. And I think that's something that people don't really remember.
What's interesting also is that at one gala dinner at the White House, when JFK was president, who was sitting at the head table but Charles Lindbergh? Kennedy tried to rehabilitate Charles Lindbergh, but something else. When John Kennedy was a young congressman from Massachusetts, well, let me back up a little bit. 1946, the war is over. FDR is dead. The Republicans win the midterm elections in 1946. People want a change. It's enough of war, enough of the Democrats. The Republicans win, and what is the first thing that they do in the beginning of 1947? They ram through the 22nd Amendment, although it has to be ratified by the states. But nevertheless, they ram through the 22nd Amendment. What is the 22nd Amendment? No third term for a president. This is an anti-FDR amendment that takes away from voters the right, the freedom, to re-elect the person they want. If they want Bill Clinton, if they want Ronald Reagan, people should have the right to have these people in a democracy. Also, as Alexander Hamilton said, there might be a national emergency when you want to continue the man in office, the man with the most experience. But Republicans vote for the 22nd Amendment, and a few Democrats do, and which one does? John Kennedy of Massachusetts votes for this anti-FDR amendment. Very curious.
Let's talk a little bit about another man in the room and in history, and that's Joe Stalin. How does he play into 1940?
What's interesting is that that's part of the isolationist movement. At first, the American communists are anti-fascist and they're interventionists. Then there's a Hitler-Stalin pact, and then the American communists...
The famous non-aggression treaty.
Yes, and then the American communists become isolationists. And then Hitler invades Russia, and the American communists make another switch. So the isolationists at least can depend on the Stalinists for at one point in their history.
You know, Susan Dunn, I've always thought that if you look back, and it's always easy to do this, at Hitler's greatest mistakes... One of them, of course, was the invasion of the Soviet Union. Why he had to do that when he was, you know, fighting this stuff in England and could potentially have invaded and the rest, and also the scapegoating of the Jews. Now, I understand the scapegoating from a perspective of how to motivate potential followers, which worked for him. But both of those seem to me to be the reason he lost the war.
Oh, it's such a complicated question. The other mistake that Hitler did was declare war against the United States after Pearl Harbor.
Most people think we did it, but he did it.
He declared war against us.
Because he had had a treaty relationship with the Japanese.
Yeah.
So you have this year, 1940. Now, Susan, you decided to write this book published by Yale University, 1940. Why 1940? Why not 1941?
It is an election year, and I found the election itself so interesting. The two conventions. Also, the whole issue of the third term. FDR is now running for an unprecedented third term in office. The first American president to run for a third term, and the only American president to run for a third term, and then in 1944, for a fourth term.
So we have to remember that George Washington said no, that you know, our most popular...
Started a tradition, but George Washington believed in no term limits. He didn't want term limits. He agreed with Alexander Hamilton, who wanted a strong executive, didn't want term limits. Hamilton wanted, even said that he would like a kind of elective monarch. So term limits were always anathema.
Yeah, but Washington didn't run for that.
And that's because he was bone tired. He doesn't run for a third term in 1796 when Adams runs. But George Washington started military service in the 1750s in the French and Indian Wars.
Sure.
This man really is tired. And in fact, he wanted to resign from the presidency after the first term in 1792. And Hamilton and Jefferson, who agreed on nothing, agreed that Washington had to stay in office. The country was still so new and needed Washington as the political leader, but perhaps even more important as the symbolic leader of the nation. So that tradition, in a way, was a phony tradition.
When it was coming, when the war was coming, 1940, 1941, we see the war begin, what was going on in the United States in terms of infiltration? I'm talking about the Bund. I'm talking about the German population in the United States. I'm talking about the Nazi infiltration. What can you tell us about that?
There is fifth column activity during the election coming out of the German embassy and German consulates around the country. They are a propaganda machine. They have to be very careful. They don't want to be accused of interfering in American politics or American culture, American society. So they have to play a very hidden, clandestine game, but they do. They could have been more effective if they had been less stingy, if they had spent more money. But they were tight-fisted, and that hurt them. Nevertheless, they did support isolationist congressmen. They did plant phony news stories. They published pamphlets. They had radio broadcasts. They supported some American authors. One of them is somebody like Theodore Dreiser and other authors. They planted ads in newspapers, Stop the War ads. They were quite active.
So when we look to 1940 and to this cast of characters who were so important, you do make the argument, I think we've heard this today, that there were some great men involved in this, the great man theory of history. Maybe change out Churchill, because there are those people who thought that Britain at some point was ready to make accommodation with the Nazis, that they may have had to do that. You change out Roosevelt, and you might have had an entirely different outcome for all of this. You change out Wendell Willkie, as you say. If Lindbergh becomes the candidate.
Or Robert Taft, or another Taft. Republican, yes.
Yeah, we could have had a whole different history.
Yes,
you know,
that's absolutely true.
In this world. And that's why 1940 becomes very important. Give us a taste of those conventions.
The Republican convention was very interesting because Willkie, in the beginning of the convention, he was the dark horse. Nobody thought he had a chance. But what happens, as I mentioned, France surrenders to Hitler on June 22nd, that changes the whole convention, as if Hitler is there in Philadelphia at the convention. So it's a very unstable convention. It's a very open convention. Nobody knew what was going to happen. They go through six ballots, I think, that they can't agree. The numbers of votes keep shifting. Dewey is on top. Dewey, who was the New York district attorney, who had inspired radio shows called Gangbusters and a movie with Humphrey Bogart and Betty Davis called Marked Woman. So there's Thomas Dewey, New York DA. And there's,
who gets his chance, obviously.
Later on, gets his chance. And there's Robert Taft. Even Herbert Hoover thinks he has a chance to make a comeback. Michigan Senator Arthur Vandenberg thinks he's got a chance. But it's a very open, truly democratic with a small D convention. No, it's not fixed. No one knows who's going to win. Wilkie wins.
How does Wilkie win?
Great strategists, some great speakers, and the war. What's happening in Europe? This makes people scared of the isolationists at the convention. And the Republicans are smart to not pick an isolationist when Europe is falling to the Nazis. The Democratic convention in Chicago is the opposite. It's fixed. There's no drama. There's no openness. FDR has manipulated the convention from the get-go. He's pulled all the strings. How has he done it? Not by saying that he wants the nomination. Oh, no. He has to wait until there's a unanimous call, and then he says, if you're drafting me, I can't say no to a draft because I'm about to draft other young men and ask them to make sacrifices. So I, who wanted to go back to Hyde Park and open my library and retire and live the quiet Hudson River life, oh no, I'm going to sacrifice my personal happiness for service to the country. And that's how he stages himself, in a way the way George Washington also staged himself.
I'm sorry, Susan, but because he was so canny, there were others within the Democratic Party who literally thought he might not run. And as a result, they were sort of trying to position themselves.
And he wanted that. Some people say that FDR torpedoed all the other candidates. In fact, he did the opposite. He encouraged every Democrat, every possible nominee to run.
Like, who were some of them? Farley, right?
Jim Farley, the head of the National Democratic Convention. Even Joe Kennedy got a pat on the back. Paul McNutt, the governor of Indiana. Cordell Hull, Secretary of State. Every possible Democrat, he'd say, yes, yes, you've got a good chance, you should run.
And he encouraged them personally to run.
Absolutely. Charles Edison encouraged him to run for Democratic governor of New Jersey, et cetera, et cetera. Why did he want all of these candidates to run? So that they would all cancel one another out, and he would be left standing. He would be the obvious choice. And that's exactly what happened.
And who does he choose as his vice presidential candidate?
That was interesting. He's nominated in Washington, and he doesn't accept the nomination. He says, you have to go one step further, he tells the convention. You have to give me the man I want to be vice president, and it's Henry Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture.
Who was a darling of the progressive or left part of the party.
Absolutely. And FDR has confidence in him. He thinks he's a real internationalist. If something should happen to FDR, he trusts Wallace to do the right thing. The problem is that nobody at the convention wants Wallace.
Because? And
partly because they don't like him. They think he is too far left. Partly simply because they're angry at FDR that he wants them to be slavishly obedient to whatever he wants. And they've had it. The mood is becoming more and more sour at the convention. They don't want to give in to FDR another time. FDR sees that. And what happens? He sends Eleanor Roosevelt to Chicago at the last minute to try to calm down the convention and calm down the delegates. And she makes a speech and says, oh, FDR is going to have such a hard time as president in this world catastrophe that's going on. So at least give him the man he wants. And ultimately, there's a lot of booing for Wallace, but the convention does elect him. Then it comes out shortly after the convention that Wallace has written some bizarre letters to his guru. He has a guru, and they're Dear Guru letters, and it's about mysticism, and he's out there. So it's very weird. And the White House insiders, Harold Ickes and Morgenthau and Sam Rosenman, are very, very upset when they find out that one newspaper has gotten copies of the Dear Guru letters. And they're thinking that maybe they can get rid of Wallace and dump him from the ticket. It's too late.
The guru, a la Thomas Eagleton. We know what that mistake would have been.
Yes. But it's interesting. The guru letters never come out. They're never published. And the White House was so afraid that they'd be published. And why aren't they published? Because if the White House, if the Republicans release the guru letters about Wallace, then the White House can inform about Wendell Willkie and his mistress. Wendell Willkie has a wife back home in Indiana, but Wendell Willkie is quite public about living with his quite well-known mistress, Aretha Van Doren, who's the book editor of the New York Herald Tribune. And he loves his mistress. There's even a movie based on this that comes out after the war called State of the Union. First it was a Broadway play, then it's a movie with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, who else, and Angela Lansbury, State of the Union. And there you see the arrangement of Wendell Willkie, his wife, and his mistress. At any rate, the White House basically makes a deal with the Republicans. If they don't release the guru letters, they won't spill the beans about Wendell Willkie and his mistress.
Well, of course, Susan Dunn, I could go on talking to you for the next 3 days. You are a whiz. It's always fascinating to talk to Susan Dunn. The book is 1940, FDR, Willkie, Lindbergh, Hitler, The Election Amid the Storm by Susan Dunn. It's published by Yale University Press. It's a wonderful book. I encourage everybody to get it, read it, because we haven't begun to do justice to everything you'll learn. But we've learned a lot today. And Susan, I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Alan. This was really a lot of fun talking with you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.